You are listening to Journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Good afternoon, and good evening, and good morning to everybody here at Revelation Radio? Yes, today is Revelation Radio. So, tonight I'll be speaking with Dave Patrick. And Dave Patrick is an author, a certified quantum touch practitioner. Anybody wants to know about that, go to quantumtouch.com. He's based in Nairn, which is just along the coastline from where I live in Moray. Up in Scotland, near Inverness, and his interests in the life and works of Arthur Conan Doyle led him to the White Eagle Lodge, which led him to the his conversations with Arthur Conan Doyle to Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh. He created a new book, which is the View Beyond, which involves Francis Bacon and Arthur Conan Doyle and all of these things. And he's now written the third book, which is called The Cathar View. And we'll be talking tonight about the third book, because that's what's just been published. If you want to refer to a website, this is thecatharview.com. I'll spell that CATHARVIW. So Cathar. CATHARVIEW.com. There is a Facebook page as well called The Cathar View. We'll give Dave's contact details later on. But I'd like to welcome to Journeys with JP, Mr. Dave Patrick. Good evening.
Good evening, Jeremy. Great to be here tonight.
Lovely to have you. Actually, a rare circumstance is you're actually here in my quote studio.
Yeah, it's like something out of James Bond movie.
AKA Man Cave. We're deep underground.
Yeah.
There's a waterfall over there, and that keeps the whole place cool because it's very close to the centre of the earth.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, welcome to the...
Thanks, Jeremy. The first thing to say is these three books you've mentioned, I'm the editor of the books, and obviously a contributor as well. But for each of them, I was delighted that we actually had over 20 contributors for each book. So, each of them are quite eclectic by nature. The first one on Conan Doyle was for his 150th anniversary of his birth, and that was in 2009. Francis Bacon book in 2011 was to honour his 450th anniversary. And the Cathar View, which is published two weeks ago, isn't specifically an anniversary as such, but it's quite interesting that there was a prediction made in Cathar times back in the 12th, 13th centuries that in 700 years the laurel will bloom again.
And the laurel?
The laurel, yeah, which yes. is... yeah.
Is it's, that a specific laurel tree, or is it...
Well, I think...
What's the laurel...
Well, the laurel, I think there is obviously a spiritual significance to the Cathars. I mean, I'm not an expert on the Cathars as such, as I said, when we discussed things earlier. I mean, maybe what I'd like to talk about more tonight is the synchronicities that led me into this direction. And you spoke about the secret history of the world.
Yes.
And we know, I'm not a historian, I'm not an academic. And it's quite amazing how I've kind of got into this kind of route.
You have taken a rather... unusual semi-academic approach. You've done lots of research, and you brought the references in, but you're also using your own exploration to carry on your journey. Because this show is called Journeys. It's about people's journey and how they get to where they get to. How your destiny works out, essentially. So it's lovely to to have you come through this this path, which is taking in stuff from, you know, what a lot of people would gaze at, you know, old stuff, you know, what's all that stuff, what does it all mean? But it's incredibly significant to today's world.
Absolutely. And absolutely.
So, Dave, for a moment, would you take us through, if you can, really briefly, how you came from the, well, what got you into Arthur Conan Doyle? And and remember that, you know, you're talking to an audience who's never heard very much about this kind of stuff, or maybe a couple of
Okay. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, back in about, I don't know, 2004 thereabouts, I started to take an interest in his life, and most people know Arthur Conan Doyle, if at all, through his him being the creator of Sherlock Holmes, master detective, of course. But what I found was that I was taking interest in the man's life and works, because I couldn't believe that one person could achieve so much in only, you know, 71 years on the planet. He only lived to the age of 71. And yet he wrote so many books, apart from Sherlock Holmes, who had historical novels, etc. But the direction I came from in this one was through his spiritualist leanings, because in the last particularly 15 years of his life, having been a total sceptic for about 30 years, he then became a really firm advocate for spiritualism, the case for the afterlife, the hereafter, reincarnation, etc. And remember, Conan Doyle was a scientist, he was a doctor, so it wasn't some kind of namby-pamby, you know, spurious kind of away with the fairy stuff, you know. And I also felt that he'd got a bit of a bad press from conventional media. You know, he'd got into spiritualism because he'd lost his son and his brother in the First World War. Well, for a start, he'd already come out about spiritualism before they died, and they weren't killed in action at all. They succumbed to the Spanish flu, you know. So a lot, and then of course there was the Cottingley fairy stuff, and I think the jury's still out on at least one of these photographs. Anyway, so that's what kind of led me into it. When I moved up to this part of the country from Aberdeenshire, I got involved in a series of things that led me to the Spiritualist Church. And, to, you know, I started to check things out, started to get lots of messages from mediums, started to, you know, look at it further. And then the seminal moment came, and this was back in about 2005, but 2007, somebody in the Spiritualist Church Library gave me a copy of a book called Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook. Now, I'd never heard of this book. I'd never heard of Ivan Cook. And when I read it, it blew me away, because it turned out that Ivan Cook was the husband of Grace Cook, who was a spiritualist medium back in the 1920s. White Eagle was her spirit guide. And there was also a connection with the Palais Brotherhood in France, at that time as well.
The what Brotherhood?
The Polaire. P-O-L-A-I-R-E.
Yeah, now that's a very unfamiliar name.
Yeah, well, interestingly, there's a connection there with the Cathars.
Yeah, all right.
And especially people like Otto Rahn, who was connected with the Polaires back in the sort of early 1930s. Otto Rahn, of course, as many people will know, was reckoned to be the original model for Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, I see.
And the kind of Nazi hunting for the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, is he the guy that went to Tibet? That 7 years in Tibet was based on?
I don't think that was Otto Rahn, no.
Otto Rahn, he was called Otto, I think, as well. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, no, Otto Rahn spent a lot of time in the Languedoc region of southwest France. But just going back to the, you know, the lead up of the story, when I found out about, because what happened was that Conan Doyle channeled through White Eagle and through Grace Cook in 1931 and 32 through a whole series of sessions after he physically died in 1930, and this was what was written up in this book. So this book really laid the format for what became the White Eagle Lodge, founded in 1936 by Grace Cook and Ivan Cook. And it was just a natural progression for me to join the White Eagle Lodge that year. When it came to the publication of the first book, because I had this idea to do the book on Conan Doyle, I knew I didn't have time to write a whole book. We could get some contributors. I used the vital message as a theme. I went to see Colm Hayward, who was the grandson of Grace and Ivan Cook, as a potential contributor, because he'd written an update to this book, The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle. Mm-hmm. There's a whole story behind this, which but one of the things that happened was a TV screen, picture of a woman came on it. That same woman, a couple of months later, when I went to meet Colin, was in a picture. It turned out it was his grandmother, Grace Cook, mm-hmm. who was on it. And we reckoned that was her coming in to give her blessing to the book, because she'd actually passed on herself in 1979. So there's all this sort of stuff going on. You know, there's these magical synchronicities. And then, of course, when I went to see Colm as a potential contributor, now this is November 2008, mm-hmm. and I wanted this book published May 22nd, 2009 for Conan Doyle's anniversary. Well, normally you'd never hope to get a book published in that amount of time, especially with, you know, I had very few contributors at the time. But Colm said, yeah, he'd be happy to contribute to the book. And by the way, have you got a publisher? I said, no. And he said, well, I run a small publishing company in London. Would you like me to publish the book for you? Now, these things don't normally happen.
But it's quite a hard slog to find a publisher, usually, isn't it?
Yeah. That's right. But of course,
and so it was all set up.
It was all set up. But, you know, we knew we were guided to do this. So the View came out on the 22nd of May. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Francis Bacon, Colm came back to me the following year and said, you know, because we always knew that we'd be doing a series of at least three books, mm-hmm. do a follow-up, and how about doing it with Sir Francis Bacon? I said, great. But I had honestly never heard of Sir Francis Bacon at that time.
Right.
That was only February 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, yeah, I'm up for it. So I learned so much from that. And the upshot of that has been that I've been invited to speak to Francis Bacon Society, which, if I can give them a plug, they're reckoned to be the oldest literary society in England that's still active, and I've actually joined the society, and I'm actually giving a talk in London at Canonbury Tower as a follow-up.
Canonbury,
yeah,
I love that place. Canonbury, it is one of the nicest parts of London I've seen.
Well, not Conan Doyle, Francis Bacon actually lived there for 10 years of his life.
I'm not surprised.
And
so it's quite close to Islington
where, that's right.
Who's the Robert Louis, not Stevenson, Treasure Island guy.
That was Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yeah, that was.
Has he got a connection with Islington?
No, it wasn't him, it was the other guy. Oh, excuse me. I've so digressed this.
Right.
Completely derailed this conversation.
No, that's okay.
So let's go.
If I can just say about the Francis Bacon Society, what I'll be doing is an update in my talk, because it's all to do with synchronicity and how information is revealed.
Yeah.
And that's going to be on the 18th of December in London. So if anybody listening in who's locally based in that area, more than welcome to come along to that talk.
Excellent.
So anyway, that was Francis Bacon, and that was published in January 2011, as you said, The View Beyond. Mm-hmm. The Conan Doyle one was called The View.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Colm said, right, how about doing a third book? And I thought, 2012, well, it's meant to be in the Mayan calendar. But no, it was on the Cathars. And I thought, okay, well, I've kind of heard of the Cathars through Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but I'm certainly no expert in the subject. And again, this magical journey of synchronicity kind of unfolded. If I can just say, the chapter that I actually write in the book, I've called it I've called it the ABC of Initiation, a journey of synchronicity via ACD, who is Arthur Conan Doyle, Bacon, and the Cathars, which is, of course, your ABC.
ABC, yes.
And because I was discerning kind of connecting trends and stuff coming through, you know, from each of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's completely different time periods, and interestingly, we're going back further in time.
That's right.
As we're going forward with progressing the series. And but all these kind of common themes were kind of coming out. And anyway, as we're getting towards, you know, publication time or actually getting the final book published, I was beginning to think, God, we're a bit short on contributors. And we actually had a White Eagle Lodge trip. 12 of us went out to southwest France in May this year. And again, and I write about this in some depth in my chapter, the most incredible synchronicities happened there, and we were bumped into people, we were introduced to people, we were taken to Cathar Caves. We ended up with about four new contributors from the Rennes-le-Château and Montségur areas.
Right.
So all this came together incredibly, you know.
So the now you mentioned a name that was familiar to me. Oh, I know Rennes Le Château. Rennes Le Château was an area in southwest France.
Yeah.
That is purported in the books, the Holy Blood, the Holy Grail, to be the place where the bloodline of Jesus via Mary Magdalene brought up their child, Sarah, and obviously continued the bloodline until then. So that was like 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And then we have the Cathars, who are about 1,000 years ago.
Yes.
Where do they come in? And how does that... can you connect those events all the way back up to the day? Well, is that too much of a hard question to ask?
Well, it was. It's a huge question. Yeah. And, as I say, I'm no expert in the Cathars. I can only tell you what I've kind of picked up along the way.
All right. So, we've only got 45 minutes, so we can't do the huge thing. So,
As far as I understand it, there's still a bit of debate about whether the Cathars originated from the Bogomils in Bulgaria and through some of these other Gnostic streams, or whether they actually started off primarily in southwest France. I mean, that Languedoc region was a real kind of maelstrom of cross currents of people from different tribes and different religions and different races crossing over. But what was interesting, when we were there, it was actually a guy, Christian Koenig, who looks after the Gedal house in a place called Ussat-Laban, where a lot of the Cathar initiation caves are, well, they're nearby. And when he took us into the area, I mean, what struck me was the kind of the serenity of the place. You know, when you imagine the Holocaust that went on, you know, and, you know, we'll discuss that in a bit of detail in terms of the amount of Cathars who were actually killed for their, quotes, heretical beliefs.
Yeah.
And yet this landscape is just so magical. And, you know, as Christian said, that, you know, we had this cross flow of people, you know, the Moors from Spain and North Africa and the Phoenicians and the Jews, etc. But they were all living in peace and harmony. And then suddenly it all kind of, you know, went wrong. Now, the connection with Rennes Le Château, because you could say there's almost like two distinct stories here, and do they actually meet? Because a lot of people will know the Rennes Le Château story through Henry Lincoln and Michael Bajent.
The Holy Blood, Holy Grail series.
Yeah, which came out in 1982. Now, I'd actually read that book when it first came out, and I was very interested at that time. All I know is that there are rumours that, you know, Berengar Saunier, this treasure that he found, you know, was it Visigoth treasure that came from Rome being plundered back in the, you know, the 5th century? Was it Templar treasure?
Yes.
Was the Templar treasure somehow connected into the Cathars? Was it indeed physical treasure? You know, and I think there's still a lot of these unanswered questions. I mean, one of the things...
still mystery around it.
Yeah, yeah. Because you get all these books coming out, and they're all saying, you know, the solution to this mystery, and then you read it, and then you think, well... are we any the wiser, you know? You know, maybe if I can bring Grace Cook back into the equation here, because...
Grace, can you hear us?
I'm sure she will be able to hear us, but she went with the Polaire Brotherhood in 1931 to... she was guided by White Eagle and the Great White Brotherhood. I mean, just to explain, that White Eagle always professed to be just a messenger, and he was a messenger for the Great White Brotherhood. Now, again, when you mention the Great White Brotherhood, that has mixed appeal for people. On the one hand, yes, they are for the light, and on the other hand, oh no, they're all part of the dark stuff.
Yeah, they're part of the New World Order.
Well, exactly, and I, you know, and all I can say is that, you know, being a member of the White Eagle Lodge, and I'm again no expert, but I know that White Eagle and what's going on through that route is definitely working for the light. You know, I'm not going to try and convince anybody; I just kind of know that. Yeah. And why would I be doing this if it's not for the light? You know, because by God, we need the light to be coming through now, and it is coming through big style.
It certainly is. And I mean, all these scandals that are coming out in our daily world, you know, people finding out new stuff about old misdeeds are, you know, it's coming right out, especially in Britain at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's quite an exciting time for all this to come together. So you're coming in and you're bringing another thing into the mix, which is the Gnostic Cathars, right? So do you want to talk a little bit about what the Cathars, where they were at? They weren't liked by the big church.
No.
Why?
Well, basically, the Cathars had a very sort of simple philosophy. I mean, they didn't worship in churches as such. They either worshipped in the open air or in caves or whatever. And they had a profound dislike for all the kind of pomp and greed and arrogance of the clergy of the day, which, of course, was the Roman Church, you know. And they also had, they were classed as heretics, because they believed in two gods. One was the good god and one was the not-so-good god, or the evil god, or whatever you want to call it. The good god was, you know, for them, it was the spiritual realms that was the reality of life, and that we were just on earth to be kind of immersed in matter, to kind of learn our lessons, but the real journey was in the spiritual level. Mm-hmm. And the bad god was really kind of pushing forward the whole materialistic outlook, you know, that physical is what it's really all about, you know, materialism. But of course, that's what's pushed us into greed and deceit and all the rest of it. And it's probably no coincidence that this consciousness is really coming to the surface now after all this time.
Yes, we're starting to rediscover what they knew.
Well, it's interesting you say rediscover. In fact, we use that term in the book. And I think that's part of it. However, I think a part of it is also that consciousness has, although the church has tried to suppress it by burning the people the books, the
churches,
manuscripts, etc., you know, tried to, you know, completely eradicate it, the consciousness has never gone away.
That's right.
And it's like the Cathars are calling through time. It's like, well, time, of course, doesn't exist in the spiritual realms as we understand it. Mm. You know, they don't work in linear time, as far as I understand it. But it's like this calling has been going out, and in fact, if I can just give a plug to one of the contributors to the Cathar View, and that's Shannon Anderson, who wrote a wonderful book called The Magdalene Awakening, and her chapter in the Cathar View is called The Call of the Cathars.
Right.
And it's like they are calling out to us, and certain people, especially who are sensitive to that kind of vibration or frequency, whatever you want to call it, are kind of tuning into it and listening and actually connecting up and doing something about it.
So it's possible, for instance, to invoke the energy of the Cathars, and almost like you're moving to a place in hyperspace that is beyond time.
Yeah.
You know, it's above the astral plane. It's in what Stuart Swerdlow calls it, the hyperspace, you know, fifth dimension or whatever you like to call it.
Yeah.
But it's the place where beyond time, that it's a timeless place. So if you're there and you're there, you can have a conversation with like Nostradamus or somebody from another period of what we call time.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this kind of connects back to Conan Doyle and Grace Cook now.
Exactly.
Because when I'd really recommend, if anybody wants to find out more about this, get hold of The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Ivan Cook. With an E?
With an E in the end of Cook, yeah. And because what Conan Doyle was saying there, apart from imparting the message, and maybe I should just briefly say what the message was, he was saying that, you know, in terms of the afterlife, what he said during his physical life was on the right track, but it wasn't the full story. But he was really saying that be careful what you think during your physical lifetime, because that's what's going to create what you end up with in the hereafter. More what you think than what you actually do, which is quite interesting. But not only that, he said that we didn't have to wait till we physically died before we brought heaven to earth, or went to heaven. We could actually bring heaven to earth in the physical reality
and live it. Yeah.
And not only that, but that death was not the kind of taboo that we've all been brought up to believe. That it was actually just a crossing over into a different dimension. You shed your physical body, but your consciousness then lived on as part of your eternal soul. So, Now, why am I connecting this back, Grace Cook, to Conan Doyle?
Because we're talking about timelessness.
Yeah, well, what he said, and it took me a little while for it to really click with me, he was saying that how difficult it was for him to communicate from the other side, because what it required was for Grace Cook to step her way up through the astral plane towards the celestial plane, and for him to kind of like step down.
Yeah.
To meet at a very high level to have that communication.
That's right, because that's what they call, you know, in the parlance that is used currently in these shows, we're talking about like the sixth or seventh dimension.
Absolutely.
He comes down from the higher dimension and she comes up.
Yeah.
Because the trick is to come through the astral plane unscathed.
Yes.
without everything distorted.
Because so much, when we talk about channeling or clairvoyance,
yes.
It's people not getting any higher than the astral plane.
Absolutely, and getting stuck and getting entities.
And that's why, a lot of it falls into disrepute. Mm. And of course, people just sort of immediately dismiss spiritualism or mediums because they look at the bad stuff and that's it.
Yeah,
you know. And I think once you start to look at it a bit more closely. And check it out with other things as well, you know, because it's very easy to kind of. You know, look at things black and white. You have a label, you know, spiritualism or whatever. And, like, a lot of the kind of research into these areas, you've kind of got to do the work. You know, check things out. Like I said, when I came across information that, you know, purported to be about Conan Doyle when he lived, about why he got into spiritualism, when I actually checked it out, the conventional wisdom turned out not to be true. But that's the kind of stuff that's still being touted out in the media. Mm. And, of course, that's why people still say, spiritualism, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's lazy thinking.
It is.
It's And journalists are the worst people at that because, you know, if a journalist has a story, they'll just go straight to the files, pick out what it is, and they've got a prejudgment there. It's already, the opinion is already formed before even the journalist gets to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where the agenda comes
from. And it's not just that. I mean, even in academic circles, you end up with this kind of closed loop of academics.
Yeah.
And they're all just cross-referencing their own material.
That's right.
And therefore never...
Kind of floating in space somewhere.
Yeah, because... And then you end up with, there's a vested interest to keep that kind of reality going. Yeah. And anything that comes along that's going to challenge it is like, you know, they'll just try and knock it back.
Mm.
I mean, just to give you an example of that, when I was coming back from our London launch, I was sitting in the train, a couple of guys behind me, who had just met for the first time by the sound of it, and I just happened to listen to a conversation. It turned out they'd both been archaeologists, or they'd done archaeology training at university, and they were having a laugh about these wacky theories about Atlantis and stuff, and how, you know, in their classes they were kind of shown these theories, and these theories, and then shown why they couldn't possibly be true. And I thought, I didn't interrupt, but I felt like saying, well, what about the Austrian guy, I forget his name, but who came up with the tectonic plate theory back in the 1915 or whatever, and he was lampooned at the time. And yet we now talk about tectonic plates and earthquakes just as a matter of that's reality of the way the earth is constructed.
Well, the idea is ridiculed.
Absolutely. But that's, going back to, research, I started to think about this because, it's one thing to say, well, I'm not an academic, then what am I? And, one of the things I can say is that I followed, my kind of synchronistic kind of patterns that have kind of, it's been a kind of flow situation. Mm. Pay attention to something that comes up and then you find that something, validates it, maybe a week later or whatever. I mean, from a scientific point of view, you can't convince anybody through, scientific channels. All you can do is share your story. Mm. If it resonates with people, fine. If it doesn't, fine. But at least let people consider it. Don't just say, oh, well, that can't possibly be true.
Yeah.
Because if you're looking at stuff like the Cathars, well, one, a lot of the information was written by the Catholic Inquisition, who were the ones who ruthlessly. So a lot of that information is questionable to start with.
Your journalist story, already judged, already...
Yeah. A lot of the information is missing anyway. So you've got to kind of, apart from having the information, you've got to kind of use your imagination, you've got to use your intuition, you've got to use inspiration. I think also in my case, it's looking at the invisible realms as well. And let's not kid ourselves that we're doing this at a 3D human level. Mm. We are being helped from I would say, light entities from other dimensions. I certainly know that I'm being guided. I can't prove it. I just kind of know. Clairsentience, I suppose. And all I can do is just share that story. And then, to me, that's what I mean about the initiate's journey, because you're picking up new information, which is illuminating, and then you're coming back to information at a completely different level. And as you're kind of sharing it, and then you're getting feedback, and then that's how you start to progress and hopefully evolve. There's a kind of alchemical aspect to this as well.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of what the Cathars were about is the transformation of
That's
humanity.
Right. Yeah, because they used alchemy in not in the sense of converting lead into gold, you know, the tradition.
It's the metaphor.
Yeah, spiritual alchemy.
To improve the human to become the golden being.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as far as I understand, Francis Bacon carried on that tradition as well. But of course, you know, trying to sort of look at these things in the past and current day context is very, very difficult, because these were such ruthless times. You know, in Elizabethan times, when Francis Bacon was alive, you know, it's hardly any wonder they had to conceal a lot of the information they were putting out there.
Because there were lots of very stupid people with very dangerous weapons.
Absolutely. And but if
actually, what's changed?
But I think we're now reaching this point now, and we discussed earlier, you know, there are new vibrations coming into the planet. The light seems to be flooding in. The truth is coming to the surface, and it's not going to be hidden away anymore.
Yes.
You know, so I think this is, you know, in terms of the next evolution, and we talk about ascension and disclosure and all these sort of good things, but I think to bring it into context, there's definitely something afoot. You know, time as we know it's speeding up.
Yeah.
Well, this year just seems to whiz by.
Interesting. We've only done half an hour on the show, which we've managed to cram a lot of info into this first half hour.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because sometimes the show goes by like this. So you know, we're doing all right here.
Okay. Well, I hope this is of interest to people out there.
Oh, certainly. There's a lot of people that are actually listening to what we're saying. Sovereign says, yes, academics have their boxes into which everything must fit so their own theories don't get upset.
Yeah.
Is that the Inquisition with the comfy chair? Actually, and Dave is sitting in the comfy chair this evening.
Yes.
So here we have, so we've got the Cathars. We've got the events of 2,000 years ago, but the Cathars 1,000 years ago, bringing us up about 400-500 years ago is Francis Bacon and John Dee and those people.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the last century, have Conan Doyle
and
the Cooks and people like that.
Yeah.
Let's have a little look at other things that the Cathars were talking about, and they were kind of warning us or telling us about what is going on. Because let's go to the dark side, right? Mm. You mentioned earlier this word, demiurge.
Yes.
Now, this is an unusual sounding word. Demiurge, it means like half of something. Mm. What is, mm. what, do you know the etymology? You know, why the word etymology? Etymology. One of them is insects, one of them is words. Anyway.
As far as I understand it, I think demiurge is the equivalent of what they would consider to be the evil god. The god of matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume you want to sort of mention about the archons here.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because, again, this is what I was saying earlier about paying attention to things that come up in quick succession.
Yes.
Because I had never heard of archons. And just to explain to people, it's spelled Archons. Until about maybe 3 months ago, I stumbled across it in a YouTube video. And I can't remember the guy's name, but it was a Welsh writer, he was talking about him, and I thought, okay, it sounds a bit kind of interesting, but I wasn't totally convinced.
Mm.
And then, having relocated back here from England, I bought a book on the Rosicrucians in a second-hand bookshop down in a place called Finding. Harridan Books is the name of the place. A very, very fine second-hand bookshop near Wellingborough in Northamptonshire. And anyway, I got the book on the Rosicrucians, and lo and behold, here's something written in one of the early chapters about the Demiurge and the Gnostics and the Archons. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then, as you know, I went to the David Icke event on the 27th of October, a week after a book launch.
Oh, fantastic, that.
At the Wembley Arena, and it really was fantastic.
8 hours?
It started off about 10:30 in the morning till 10 o'clock in the evening in four sections.
Lord. So, you know, yeah. 11 or 12 hours. What an energy that man is.
Fantastic.
And, yeah. And it's such a big story that you know that he's able to break it down into a very acceptable but understandable, because it's complex, but into a very understandable way for the people to understand, you know, like the common person.
Absolutely.
He's got the common touch to he's not over academic, but he's done a lot of research.
Yes.
So back to the Cathars, the Demiurge and the Archons. Could you talk a little bit about what the relationship between those three are? The Cathars were, they were like, you know, you couldn't say that they were like a meditation group or a cult or something like that. They were a group of people who believed in a particular thing. Were they of a bloodline?
No, not as far as I'm aware. And in fact, they didn't see themselves as a kind of organised religion.
Mm-hmm.
They were more individualised in smaller groups. But they had the common philosophy that, and as I understand it, a lot of their...
John the Divine, this is the Book of John.
This is the Book of John.
Right, which is not in the Gnostic, it's not in the Synoptic Gospel, or whatever you call them. Yeah.
There is obviously a Gospel of John, but as I understand it, there's some kind of secret Gospel that predated it.
All right.
Also known as the Book of Love. And whether or not this still exists, I mean, that's again a bit of an open question. But again, we're back to this. Well, I'm saying again, I've actually touched on it. Because if I, you know, just come straight out, what connects Conan Doyle, Bacon, and Cathars?
Yeah.
It's the choice that we have, love over fear. And what is the big choice that's been shown everywhere nowadays?
Yeah, love over fear.
Exactly. Because we have a fear driven society at the moment.
Yeah.
We've got, that's the evolution. It's love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's love.
Universal, unconditional love.
Exactly.
Yes.
And let's see, so everything is kind of like pointing in that direction. So go back to, you know, Cathars, Demiurge, the Archons. I haven't actually looked at the Archons in connection with Cathars directly, but as I see it, the Archons are some kind of other dimensional reality that sits behind a lot of what we're seeing going on in the world. And I would speculate that it is kind of permeating through our politics, through our banking, through our corporations, and it's right in our face now, you know, with greed, deceit, you know, the whole thing. It's almost disgusting now, you know, how far it's reached. But people are definitely awakening more and more. More and more people are awakening more. There are still people who are still carrying on and going out, you know, things are just much the same as before.
Mm.
But I think we're reaching that kind of critical mass now, that things are definitely changing.
Another thing comes to mind at the moment. There was one other group who also had a view of the Archons, and that's the Essenes, all the way back 2,000 years ago,
right,
contemporary with Jesus. They also spoke of the Archons in the
Demiurge.
Well, yeah. But that's a new introduction, so we won't bother with that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because
funnily enough, part of the research for the Kathar book was I went on a retreat at the White Eagle Lodge last July, August 2011, and in fact it was Colin Hayward who ran the retreat, and the three, and it was on the ancient brotherhoods, and the three brotherhoods that we looked at were the Essenes, the Cathars, and the Kalairs.
Right.
So isn't it part of the same mix? So if you're saying we are constellations, we can know now that there have been situations behind the scenes, but that is becoming much more visible, well, certainly in my eyes, because again, it's interesting to tell me what life has been seen to me relatively recently. And so somehow it's clear it's become very
Sorry, I keep going. I'm having a bit of problem with the audio here. I'm just turn that one up there. With that one. I think I've got a problem with the other mic. And, speak to us.
Hello.
Oh, how's right, that? Now we've got you back. Oh, okay. Right, so there's a loose connection on the microphone.
Right.
Okay, so sorry about that. So, back to the Cathars, the Archons, and the Essenes and their Archonic connection. So, what it seems like, that the Archons are, you know, we've always had this idea, you know, the world is run by some bad energy.
Yes.
And we've also been told that the Archon, the Lord of the world is not, you know, Jesus Christ or anything, but it's the demiurge. It's the material dark god, the materialistic dark god. So how does all that fit together, and what's their modus operandi? How do you tell whether you're coming across dark influences, or is that out of your research? Let's go back.
Yeah,
We have the Archons, this, you know, talked about by the Essenes. We have the Archons talked about by the
Gnostics,
and the Cathars,
and the Rosicrucians,
and they all talk about these people, beings.
But we're
never really given an idea of who or what they are, except now we're told about reptilians and greys.
Well, that's right, and of course that's, I mean, just going back to David Icke, I mean, a lot of people say, oh yeah, I can take a lot of what David Icke says, but when it comes to the reptilian bit, it's a stretch too far. Now, I think that's one of these things that unfortunately does, knock people to one side a little bit, because these entities, if they're non-human, you know, well, what are they? Does it really matter? I mean, it's very hard to put into words. But if they're working from, say, a fourth dimensional reality, and we're in 3D, then obviously, you know, that they're going to have a certain power over us. But I understand that this goes right back, you know, thousands of years, that you know, there has been interbreeding with humanity. And you mentioned about bloodlines earlier on, and this is why keeping the bloodlines pure in their eyes is so important, because the Archons themselves cannot operate in a 3D world, but their hybrids can. So it's almost like they've created that crossing over point between dimensions. Mm-hmm. And this is where it becomes, you know, it can sound a bit wacky, but when you start to imagine, well, how could this be happening? Yeah. It all really starts to make sense, and how it's actually been played out. And to me, the main way it's been played out is through the international banking system. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where the real power has been lying, and that's where the control has taken place. And of course, that's permeated through government, through the corporations, etc. And then, of course, you have this link up between the Archons and psychopaths. Interestingly, David Icke, I think, mentioned that about 4% of the population were Archonic by nature or by the way they were. And Thomas Sheridan, the Irish Thomas Sheridan, who has done a lot of work in psychopaths, reckons that 4% of the population are clinical psychopaths by birth.
So you think that's the same 4%?
So I think there must be a huge crossover between the two. And I know we're sort of going into a slightly different subject, but it's all part of the same power play.
It's extremely relevant because these are the people who are running it.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if people can remember a film that came out and a book that was written in 2004 called The Corporation, it was a group of Canadian producers who made this film. And what they did was they looked at corporations, which of course are legal entities in their own right, but they looked at them as though they were a person, and they actually gave them a psychological profile. And in every case, they came across the fact that, they came to the conclusion that if they were treated as people, then these corporations would be classed as psychopathic by nature. Now, of course, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to make the link. You know, if you've got corporations who are psychopathic by nature, that it's going to attract into the senior management a lot of people who are psychopaths. And I think we can see it without actually naming names, because I don't particularly want to be sued. But we can mention the Royal Bank of Scotland as an area for some close scrutiny. We could also mention some former prime ministers, for example, as well. And I think you said something about how can you tell these people. I think you can tell by just the look in their eyes. Because what you find with them is there's no compassion, there's no empathy, there's just nothing. There's no remorse. So, as I say, you know, looking at what lies behind the power structures, and of course we're in the US election at the moment, and we don't really want to go down that route, but, you know, because where does the real power lie?
It's nothing to do with
Obama and Romney, because they're just puppets of something that's going on behind the scenes. You know, whether they want to call it the Bilderbergers, the Committee of 300, blah blah blah, it's all interconnected.
What's interesting, as we were discussing before the show, is that forever there's this same pattern of behaviour.
Yeah.
There is a front, and there is a reality. So, for instance, we might look at, the powers that be. So we look at the presidents, and behind the presidents is this committee of 300, or the Council of Foreign Relations, or Trilateral Commission, and all that. And then behind that is the 300 families, and then behind that is the 12 families, and behind that is the Jesuits, and behind that are the Archons.
Yes.
It seems. You know, it's like it's like Russian dolls.
Yes.
And right in the middle, the tiny little nugget, the kernel, is this fourth dimensional, other dimensional creature, which we call the Archon.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Well, I have a theory in this one, if I can maybe just...
Go ahead. You know,
that if we're talking about ascension into fourth and even fifth dimension, well, from a simplistic point of view, does that not mean that we have the potential to transcend the dimensionality of the Archons and actually
move beyond
and actually see them for what they are from a higher vantage point?
Here is a very interesting moment.
Yeah.
Because according to some of the guests that I've had, a gentleman called Tolek, who's an Andromedan contactee.
Oh, right, okay.
He was saying that at this moment, in this year, we're moving through the fourth dimension.
Yes.
And so I think what you're saying is actually quite right, that the reason that we're seeing all these paedophile scandals, all that, you know, people are actually seeing the voting that is being rigged at the moment in order to get Romney in, because he's the one who went to the Bilderbergers. Meeting, you know, it's like it's very, very plain to us now, and there are a great number of people who are getting this idea that we have a shadow behind what we're seeing. And it's interesting that at this moment we're now looking behind the shadow. It's like the theatre has moved. We're no longer on the stage. We're now looking backstage towards the audience.
Yeah.
We're seeing the outplaying of these plans that they've made.
Yes.
Who's the actor behind the mask?
Well, that's right. And I suppose another kind of, in a sense, challenge for me, or paradox, or whatever you want to call it, and I share this in my chapter in the Cathar View, and I speak about it quite openly. After I'd edited the first book, The View, in a channeling session with Shirley Colday, who's a friend and who's also a contributor to The View. She brought in, purportedly, Sanat Kumara, whom I'd not heard of at that time.
Mm.
And I was told that this work that I was doing on The View was a dry run for the real work they wanted me to do. They being, as I understood it, the Ascended Masters, mm-hmm. whom I knew very little about at that point in time. This is about, you know, about 2009. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the information I know I've been guided through, but of course a big question mark for me is, well, if we've got these guys in the Great White Brotherhood who have got these higher dimensional capabilities, why are they not sweeping away all this archonic and dark stuff? But there seems to be something that's challenging humanity. It's almost like we've got to step up to the plate, to use that metaphor.
You are absolutely spot on.
That it's something to do with our evolution.
We have to come up with it.
Yes.
And actually, it's not the men, it's the women have to step up now. And this is, I mean...
And the men find their... feminine aspect of balance as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it's like even the men can't tell the women to do things because that's still domination.
Yes.
The women need to recognize it in their hearts and to actually speak out and step up. And basically the women have to say no more.
Yes.
And that seems to be the message that's coming through. Dave, we've got about seven, 8 minutes now. Okay. We'll hear a little beeping sound like a telephone when the show's over. Well, so why don't you just take us out?
Okay, well, I mean, it's interesting, again, we talk about women, you know, the whole, as I said, about Shannon Anderson's book, which I really recommend, you know, The Magdalene Awakening. Again, Mary Magdalene's coming through so much, and she's coming through the Cathar line, coming through the Rennes Le Chateau, you know... the church in Rennes Chateau is to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Very interesting church, well worth a visit. So we've got all this kind of, you know, this really positive, loving wave that's coming through. And to me, it's unstoppable. Maybe on the banking side, if I can just reflect on something. I don't know if I said, but a few weeks ago, I was brought in at the last minute to a panel discussion at the Wigton Book Festival, and it was a great opportunity to be involved because it's now the biggest book festival in Scotland alongside Edinburgh. Mm. And the panel was discussing, or the theme was Inside the Minds of the Bankers.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that's a great opportunity. And it turned out one of the guys in the panel was an ex-Barclays Bank guy who's now the business editor of The Spectator. Of course, he was taking a kind of banker's kind of, you know, basically saying, oh, they're just like the rest of us, and yeah, it's just they couldn't manage risk and all this stuff. And of course, I took a completely different view, and I brought in the psychopathic bit and the corporations, what do you expect? And I mentioned about the criminalisation of the world banking system, and he said, oh, you can't say that. I mean, you know, they haven't actually been brought to, you know, up for any crimes. I said, well, yeah, but if you look at the LIBOR rate rigging, I mean, that's criminal.
Yeah, and the gold salting. Yeah.
And he said, no. He said, because they were all doing it, they were cheating, but it wasn't criminal. And that's the kind of culture, that's, you know, in all its aspects that we have to sweep away
now.
And it's down to every single one of us. Yes. We can't expect them, whoever them is.
No one is going to come and save you. We have to save ourselves. Yeah,
exactly. You know, it's not a question of saving.
Yeah.
It's a question of wakening up and, you know, looking at life and saying... life could be so much better once we break free of this matrix. I mean, the matrix is true. You know, we have been living in this closed down, shut down matrix.
Phased gravitation wave, apparently.
Oh, well, okay. I'll take your word
for
that.
My guest on Sunday, high scientist. Anyway,
you're right.
But one
of the things I was going to say, I mean, I made the point that where we've got to with the, you know, the world banking system, we're not going to incrementally shift away from where we're at now. You know, all the austerity measures and what have you aren't going to make one iota of difference because the world's completely bust.
Yes.
You know, we've got derivatives swirling around of, you know, a quadrillion plus or minus, dollars, pounds, doesn't really matter, of paper value, but are actually worthless. So any kind of austerity is just it's just rubbish.
It's all a fake.
Of course, it's just a big illusion.
Yeah.
So what we, you know, and I say this to listeners as well, what we are all being asked to do now what I say about stepping up to the plate is to say, we know things are going to change, we know things are going to collapse. Don't be fearful of it. Mm. Keep optimistic. Do what you can with positive, loving intent in your sphere of influence. And then, you know, we've got to decide what can we co-create in its place. Absolutely. And we're not co-creating this on our own. We have, as I say, these positive entities from the other realms, whether we call them ascended masters or whatever, who I generally think have been coming in to, overlight us at, key parts of our development. You know, we're talking about Saint-Germain or, other masters.
Well, Jesus, or exactly, Kutumi, or all these guys, yeah.
Sananda, and I mentioned about Sanat Kumara, and I've understood a bit more about
By the way, for the people, Sanat Kumara is the name of the planetary Logos.
Yes.
Logos means the word. In the beginning was the word.
Yeah.
In the beginning was Sanat Kumara. He's the overarching spiritual representation of the divine part of the planet.
Yes.
Yeah, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, the Ancient of Days was
the Ancient of Days, Babaji, Maitreya is his current incarnation, and all these things that are, he was Jesus in those days, he was the Buddha, he's all of these characters, they're all incarnations of the planetary Logos.
Okay, well, I can't comment on that because I don't have that level of expertise. But all I can say is all I can say is that there have been, we are being guided by light beings of higher dimensional abilities, and Conan Doyle. If we go full circle and go back to Conan Doyle, as he's moved to the other side, we know that he is definitely an ascended master. And he is still working with us to show us the way. And isn't it interesting that Conan Doyle, through the Sherlock Holmes movies, the Sherlock Holmes TV series, Bacon with the Shakespeare question coming out now, who wrote the Shakespeare plays?
Dave Patrick, thecatharview.com. This is the end of the show. Thank you very much for coming to this Journey Studio.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
It has indeed. God bless you all.